Welcome back to the Hemingway List. It's the podcast where we do things the Hemingway for part 7, chapter 13. Oh, something's happening exciting. I am Norwegian, so this was my favourite chapter in ages. I didn't realise I cared so much, but the tender way it was written and the fact that we've spent so many months with these characters got me into almost the same anxious state as Levin. I can't wait to find out if Kitty will be okay tomorrow. Kitty better be okay, says Lexi 109. I will lose my shit if something happens to her. Well, let's just hope that no one loses their shit. Let's read. This was super short. That's the whole conversation. It was only those two comments. I've got nothing really to add other than that, yes, I want to see what happens to Kitty. And also, it's a bit of a longer chapter, this next one, chapter 14. So let's get it done. The doctor was not yet up, and his footman said he had gone to bed late and given orders that he was not to be called, but the footman added that he would be up soon. The man was cleaning lamp glasses and seemed quite absorbed in his task. This attention to his glasses and indifference to what was taking place at Levin's astonished Levin at first. But he immediately recollected himself and realized that no one knew or was bound to know his feelings, and that it was therefore all the more necessary to act calmly, deliberately, and firmly in order to break through this wall of indifference and to attain his aim. Do not hurry and do not omit anything, he said to himself, conscious of increasing uplift of his physical powers and of his attention to all that lay before him. Having learnt that the doctor was not up yet, Levin, out of the many plans that occurred to him, decided on the following. Kuzma should go with a note to another doctor, while he himself would go to the chemist for the opium. And if the doctor was not up when he returned, he would bribe the footman, or if that was impossible, he would enter by force and wake the doctor at all costs. At the chemist's, a skinny dispenser with the same indifference with which the footman had cleaned his lamp glasses, closed with a wafer a packet of powders for which a coachman was waiting, and refused to let Levin have any opium. Trying not to hurry and not to get excited, Levin gave names of the doctor and of the midwife, explained why the opium was wanted, and tried to persuade the dispenser to let him have it. The dispenser asked in German whether he might sell it to receive permission from someone behind a screen, took out a bottle and a funnel, slowly poured it from a large bottle into a small one, stuck on a label, and in spite of Levin's request that he should not do so, sealed up the bottle and was about to wrap it up. This was more than Levin could stand. He resolutely snatched the bottle out of the man's hand and rushed out at the big glass door. The doctor was not up yet, and the footman, now busy putting down a carpet, refused to wake him. Levin deliberately took out a 10-ruble note, and speaking slowly but without losing time, handed him the note and explained that Dr. Peter Dmitrich, how great and important this Dr. Peter Dmitrich, formerly so insignificant and now appeared to Levin, had promised to come at any time, and that he would certainly not be angry and must therefore be called at once. The footman consented and went upstairs, asking Levin to step into the waiting room. Levin could hear the doctor at the other side of the door, coughing, walking about, washing and speaking. Some 3 minutes elapsed. To Levin they seemed more than an hour. He could not wait any longer. "Peter Dmitrich, Peter Dmitrich," he called out in a tone of entreaty through the door. "For heaven's sake, forgive me. Receive me as you are. It is over 2 hours." "Immediately, immediately," answered a voice, and Levin was astounded to detect that the doctor was smiling as he said it. "Just for one moment, immediately." 2 minutes more passed while the doctor put on his boots, and 2 more while he put on his clothes and brushed his hair. "Peter Dmitrich," Levin again began in a piteous voice, but at that instant the doctor came out, dressed and with his hair brushed. "These people have no conscience," thought Levin, "brushing their hair while we are perishing. "Good morning," said the doctor, holding out his hand, and as it seemed to Levin, teasing him by his calm manner. "Don't hurry, well." Trying to be as exact as possible, Levin began recounting every unnecessary detail of his wife's position, continually interrupting himself to beg the doctor to accompany him at once. "Don't be in such a hurry. You see, you are inexperienced. I am sure I shall not be needed, but I promised, and if you like, I will come. But there is no hurry. Please sit down. Won't you have a cup of coffee? Levin gave the doctor a look, which asked whether he was not laughing at him, but the doctor had no idea of laughing. I know, he said with a smile. I am a family man myself. We husbands are the most miserable of creatures at those times. I have a patient whose husband always runs away into the stable on such occasions. But what is your opinion, Peter Dmitrich? Do you think it may go all right? All the symptoms are favourable. Then you will come at once, said Levin, looking angrily at the servant who brought in the coffee. In an hour's time. No, for heaven's sake. Well, only let me finish my coffee. The doctor began on his coffee. Both kept silence. Well, the Turks are being seriously beaten. Did you read yesterday's telegram? Asked the doctor, chewing a piece of roll. No, I can't stand it, said Levin, jumping up. So you will come in a quarter of an hour, in half an hour. On your honour. Levin got home just as the princess arrived, and they met at the bedroom door. There were tears in the princess's eyes, and her hands shook. When she saw Levin, she embraced him and began to cry. Well, Mary Vlasyevna, darling, she asked, seizing the hand of the midwife, who came toward them with a beaming but preoccupied expression. It's going all right, she said. Persuade her to lie down. It will be easier for her. From the moment when he woke up and understood what was the matter, Levin had braced himself to endure what might await him, without reasoning and without anticipation, anything, firmly suppressing all his thoughts and feelings, determined not to upset his wife, but on the contrary to calm and support her. Not allowing himself even to think of what was about to happen and how it would end, judging by inquiries he had made as to the time such affairs usually lasted, Levin mentally prepared himself to endure and to keep his heart under restraint for something like 5 hours, which seemed to him within his power. But when he returned from the doctor's and again saw her sufferings, he began repeating more and more often, God, pardon and help us, sighing and lifting his head, afraid lest he should not be able to bear the strain and should either burst into tears or run away. So tormenting was it for him, and only 1 hour had passed. But after that hour, another passed, a second, a third, and in all the 5 hours that he had set himself as the longest term of possible endurance, and still the situation was unchanged, and he went on enduring, for there was nothing else to do but to endure, thinking every moment that he had reached the utmost limit of endurance, and that in a moment his heart would burst with pity. But the minutes went by, and the hours, and the other hours, and his suffering and terror and strain grew tenser. The ordinary conditions of life, without which nothing can be imagined, no longer existed for Levin. He lost the sense of time. Sometimes minutes, those minutes when she called him to her and he held her moist hand, now pressing his with extraordinary strength and now pushing him away, seemed to him like hours, and then again hours seemed but minutes. He was surprised when Mary Vlasyevna asked him to light a candle behind the partition, and he learnt that it was already 5 o'clock in the evening. Had he been told it was 10 in the morning, he would not have been more astonished. He had just as little idea of where he was at that time as he had of when it all took place. He saw her burning face, now bewildered and full of suffering, and now smiling and soothing him. He saw the princess red, overwrought, her grey hair out of curl, and her with tears which she energetically swallowed, biting her lips. He saw Dolly, he saw the doctor smoking thick cigarettes, and Mary Vlasyevna with a firm, resolute, and tranquilizing look on her face, and the old prince pacing up and down the ballroom and frowning, but he did not know how they came and went, nor where they were. The princess was one moment in the bedroom with the doctor, and the next in the study, where a table laid for a meal had made its appearance. And next it was not the princess, but Dolly. Afterwards, Levin remembered being sent somewhere. Once he was told to fetch a table and a sofa. He did it with zeal, believing that it was necessary for her sake, and only later discovering that he had been preparing a sleeping place for himself. Then he was sent to the study to ask the doctor about something. The doctor answered him and then began talking about the scenes in the city Duma. Then he was sent to fetch an icon with silver gilt mounts from the princess's bedroom, and he and the princess's old lady's maid climbed on a cupboard to get down the icon, and he broke the little lamp that burned before it, and the old servant tried to comfort him about his wife and about the lamp. He brought the icon back with him, and he put it at the head of Kitty's bed, carefully pushing it behind the pillows. But where, when, and why all this was done, he did not know, nor did he understand why the princess took his hand, and looking pitifully at him, entreated him to be calm, nor why Dolly tried to persuade him to eat something and led him out of the room, nor why even the doctor looked seriously and sympathizingly at him, offering him some drops. He only knew and felt that what was happening was similar to what had happened the year before in the hotel of the provincial town on the deathbed of his brother Nicholas. Only that was sorrow and this was joy, but that sorrow and this joy were equally beyond the usual conditions of life. They were like openings in that usual life through which something higher became visible, and, as in that case, what was now being accomplished came harshly, painfully, incomprehensibly, and while watching it the soul soared, as then, to heights it had never known before, at which reason could not keep up with it. "Lord, pardon and help us," he kept repeating incessantly to himself, appealing to God, in spite of a long period of apparently complete estrangement, just as trustingly and simply as in the days of childhood and early youth. During the whole of that time he was alternately in two different moods, one mood when not in her presence, when with the doctor, who smoked one thick cigarette after another and extinguished them against the rim of the overflowing ashpan, when with Dolly and the prince, where they talked about dinner, politics, and Mary Petrovna's illness, and when Levin suddenly quite forgot for an instant what was happening and felt just as if he was waking up, and the other was in her presence by her pillow when his heart was ready to burst with pity and yet did not burst, and there he prayed unceasingly to God, and every time when the screams that came from the bedroom roused him from momentary forgetfulness, he succumbed to the same strange error that had possessed him in the first moments. Every time on hearing the scream he jumped up and ran to justify himself, but recollected on the way that he was not to blame and that he longed to protect and help her. But when, looking at her, he again saw that to help was impossible, he was seized with horror and said, "Lord, pardon and help us," and the longer it lasted, the stronger grew both his moods. Out of her presence he became calmer, quite forgetting her, and at the same time both her sufferings and his feeling of the impossibility of helping her became more and more poignant. He would jump up, wishing to run away somewhere, but ran to her instead. Sometimes when she had called him again and again, he was half inclined to blame her, but seeing her meek, smiling face and hearing her say, "I have worn you out," he blamed God. But the thought of God made him at once pray for forgiveness and mercy. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Ooh, 11. Cool your farm, mate. Have a nap. Have a sandwich. Have a sandwich, bro. That's what needs to happen. Chill out. Have a sandwich. It's just childbirth. Have your say about this chapter on the subreddit. Looking forward to seeing what you've got to say. I'll see you tomorrow.